Welcome back to Classy Coders, the podcast where computer science educators and technology professionals come together to explore the present and future of computer science education. Together, we're bridging the gap between classrooms and careers, equipping the next generation for a tech-driven world. This is a special edition AI episode. Over the next half hour, we dive deep into the pitfalls and promises of AI, especially on its role in the classroom, the impact an AI promises-filled future on the thoughts and choices of kids today, and what AI can and can't do. John Stapleton of Code Virginia is my guest, and we've got a lot to talk about. Keep listening. This is Classy Coders. Welcome to another episode of Classy Coders, the special AI edition. I am here with John Stapleton of Code Virginia. How are you doing, John?
Hello, Alan. It's good to see you.
Good to see you as well. I'm very, very excited for this conversation. It should be really entertaining and fun. John, what sort of expertise do you have in AI, or sort of what's your background with regard to AI? Are you a self-learner, yeah, or what's up?
Yeah, so I am a self-taught software engineer first. Goes back many, many years, and have a wide range of experiences. And then my experience with AI is in education. My primary role at Code VA is as a curriculum writer and a teacher. My background is in education, so I've taught students about AI concepts for a long time. That's been part of my curriculum since the beginning of my career, and data science topics and things like that. But these are the days before generative AI. So this is like basically statistics, machine learning stuff. And so there's that side of things, teaching students how to make like predictive models of many different kinds. I was also a lead developer on a data science curriculum that Code VA put out a couple years ago, and that has some introductory AI topics in it as well. But all that is to say that I've been in the topic for a long time, but the stuff around generative AI that happened over the past couple of years, that's sort of new to everybody, even though the concepts and the technologies have been around for a long time. And so my current kind of like gen AI experience is really as a like AI skeptic and critic in the field of computing education. That's my primary personal, that's sort of like it. I mean, you know this a little bit as someone who also works at Code VA. Like, I'm kind of the like AI skeptic person in our organization, which is, yes, kind of like a running joke a little bit. But because Code VA is in computing education and gen AI is such a huge deal, we've all had to get pretty familiar with the like problems and the risks and also the benefits and sort of interesting areas around gen AI. We've been working with, I mean, I'm trying to think, like we've presented maybe a dozen different generative AI related things over the past year and a half or so. And yeah, I think that's kind of it. I don't know. I would put myself in the camp of people who really understand the technologies from a granular level, but I wouldn't call myself an AI engineer as such. You know, my primary set of responsibilities is around teaching and learning. So I'm really concerned about, first, how do we teach people about generative AI and how it works? And then second, what are the impacts of generative AI in the classroom? And I think those are two different topic areas that I have pretty different thoughts about. The generative AI topics as a like point of interest, like a topic to study, is really cool. Like all that stuff is super interesting. The impacts of generative AI in the classroom and on teaching and learning are also really interesting, but like interesting, scary, concerning flavor.
Right.
You know?
Yes, exactly. Yes, of the other kind, the sour kind, as it were. But there is one thing that you really sort of talked about is that something that I don't know if I had a trouble connecting is like the more I learn about AI, the almost less impressed I am by it, which is a fascinating experience from a technological standpoint.
I think it's a common thing.
Yeah, it's like normally the more that you learn about a technology, like, ooh, how they make LEDs even smaller and even smaller and even smaller, like that's something that I look at and I'm like, that's kind of amazing from a manufacturing standpoint. The fact that we've by leaps and bounds made smaller and smaller chips, smaller and smaller LED arrays. These are physical things. They use us. They improve our lives. You know, like I can finally watch, you know, Lord of the Rings as it was meant to be seen. But What's fascinating is that, like, when you brought up machine learning and then machine learning as a predecessor to generative AI, is that I never really saw, I saw them happening and being created more in tandem. And by just you saying, like, I've done machine learning and I've done those sort of, like, taught how to make machine learning algorithms and those sorts of things versus the generative AI, because it is this very distinct, these two pieces of, like, recognition is one thing. Like, we can teach a computer to recognize a car relatively easily. That can be done on the device. It takes one camera, it takes one chip. And even now, especially now, like, the computing power for that is not extensive. I'm sure when it first started, it was incredible. But like, it is very realistically able to be done in, like, a classroom setting, you know, like, that's with, like, relatively inexpensive tools or just tools that you might have around. Like,
check out our curriculum library if you want to see some examples of that.
Exactly. You know, we have stuff for that, which
that's
is awesome.
Totally right. That's exactly right. And the thing, I think that the important thing to be remembering is that machine learning, largely speaking, well, actually, you know, I'm gonna back up. I was going to say that machine learning is this kind of, like, it's a strategy around how to treat data and how to make predictions. And it's like stats souped up with a huge amount of data. But what we're doing in there is there are some novel kind of approaches to that, like neural networks, convolutional neural networks. And I could just go down the rabbit hole there. We don't need to necessarily, but what they're doing with those technologies is they're building on our understanding of, like, statistics, and we're trying to make better predictions, more accurate predictions. And so there's a benchmark that we're trying to hit, right? And I think and generative AI isn't different. It's the same basic idea for how it works. You have data. Data is used to make predictions. And then you have some kind of input, like, you know, someone's voice or a sentence or whatever. And then you have some kind of predictive output. And the prediction that it's making is sort of what differentiates different kinds of technologies from one another. And the kind of machine learning object recognition that you described, like, for example, let's say we're going to try to make a model that knows if it's looking at, if there's an apple in the frame, you know, like the fruit.
Right.
So you get a bunch of apples, you got green apples, you got red apples, yellow, some different mixes, apples of different ages and sizes and species, right? And you get them all in the data set, and then you train it, and then you get a model that can tell if there's an apple in the frame or not. Once that training is done, and the training is a very energy intensive and computing intensive process, because what you're doing is processing millions, hopefully, of images of apples.
Right.
It takes really a lot of power, a lot of computing time, etc. Right. But once that model is created and you have that, like, predictive statistical model, the computing required to feed input and get output out of that model is a lot less. It's very, I wouldn't say it's, like, you know, the most efficient thing, but it's pretty efficient to use a model that way. But I think the difference between generative AI and those smaller, I say smaller, these are massive data sets, but relative to generative AI, much smaller, is that generative AI is A, scraping and trying to collect every piece of human language that is publicly available to it. It is a mind-bogglingly large sample size. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's the first thing. Every book in every library that's ever existed is being consumed simultaneously by a single computer chip. I mean, that's insane. You know,
it's very difficult. Like, in the abstract, it's easy to say that sentence, but to be able to feel the like what that actually means is really challenging. We are using the internet right now in a way that has never been used before. I can talk a little bit about some of the impacts of that usage later on.
Right.
But so the data set is huge, right? It's all, every piece of human language is valuable in this data set. And then the other thing that's different about generative AI is that all these companies that are using generative AI and deploying it are interested in using data that is being created constantly through people's interactions with the generative AI tools, but also just new things that are being published. So they're constantly retraining the models. They're not training and then using. They are constantly updating the models with new inputs. And that's where the energy use differential comes from. Generative AI is so much more expensive because the practices around collecting data and retraining the models are just different. Theoretically, if you're making a model to diagnose lymphoma, right? That goal has been around for a really long time. Lymphoma isn't you know, isn't really changing that much. There's different kinds, right? And there's lots of ways it can appear and all that. But that's a benchmark we can try to hit, right? We want the computer to understand this phenomenon enough that it can make reliable predictions. And we're still not even there yet on that narrow question. Generative AI, its goals are so much more ambiguous and big. Like, and if you look at the differences between the promises being made in this, like, predictive machine learning sort of narrow use case field and then the generative AI field, it's a very different way of approaching those technologies from the people who are making them.
Right.
Which is also super interesting.
Yeah. No, I can imagine one is, you know, like, yeah, it seems like one is a little bit more clinical, a little bit more scientific, a little bit more specific to its use case. Whereas, I mean, generative AI is being used by everybody and all the people all the time. And especially AI, I never thought about the idea that they constantly need to be retraining it, you know, and like how often that retraining happens. I mean, you'd think like, if I'm just like coming at it, if I'm coming at it from a qualitative standpoint of like, I want to make the best generative AI that I can, like there is some incentive to update it all the time. But in reality, there's probably more incentive to let people use it for a while, refine it, understand it, see where the pitfalls are, fix those pitfalls. But then if the incentive is money and, you know, like how getting more people to use it and being right. continuing to be as relevant as possible so that the things that people ask for are able to be provided by this generative AI, then all your incentive is to just update, just like keep feeding the machine,
right?
You know,
yeah. Which is I think about the benchmark, right? What's the benchmark for what makes generative AI successful?
Right.
When is the technology good?
Right.
You could, because it's used for all sorts of things. Like the promise is that it's going to replace the human diversity of labor and skill,
right?
That is a hugely ambitious goal that is, we're not even close to being able to achieve right now. So the question that a lot of AI, like, I don't want to say skeptics, AI critics maybe, or it's not even critic. It's just sort of like AI questioners.
Sure, yeah.
is like, okay, what are we trying to do with this technology? Well, like specifically, you know, what would we like generative AI to be able to do? Because right now it can generate passable writing in some contexts, sometimes, right?
Right.
It can't really do information retrieval, so maybe that's not the goal, but it can make images, which is kind of cool, but it, you know, it's not great at interpreting images yet. Like we're all kind of like, there's a lot of hype around the promises of what generative AI will do. But if you look at what it does now, and you ask yourself, okay, what are the improvements that need to happen in order for this to be really powerful technology? You start to kind of say, you hear people say things that feel really far away. We want to have an AI agent that can book travel for you is one I hear all the time. And that sounds great to me, right? I would love to not have to do that because I'm terrible at those sorts of things. But at the same time, it's kind of like, how much energy do we need to do that? How much data do we need to do that? Think about, I as a human can't really reliably navigate travel like aggregator sites because every one of them is different and they all are chaotic and there's ads everywhere and, you know, there's all sorts of scammy, like, extra buttons to click. And like, is AI going to be able to navigate that? I don't think so. Not right now. Maybe not ever, because all you have to do to get around the AI, like the competition between the AI agent and the company that's trying to make money off of the person who's using it, that all the person has to do is change what the website looks like and make it so that the website format isn't in the AI's data set. And then the AI will not be able to do anything about it. It's a very brittle technology, right?
That's a really good word to describe it in terms of brittle, in terms of like how, and that's one of the things that has made me like think a little less of AI in the past is like how quickly it can fall apart. You know, I watched one video and then tried it out of like, I asked the AI to make a left-handed person and it just can't because again, you're just, you know, like it's a data set thing. It's just, and so it's like, once you get to a certain level of understanding, and I'm by no means an expert, and I don't plan to be necessarily, but it's just the idea that a real person, a human being who went to a college, I went to college, I learned enough, semester-long courses in creating and writing algorithms, and this person is making an algorithm that helps a machine take an aggregate of tons and tons of knowledge or images, create a median within that aggregate, and then creates a slight variation on that median and then spits it out to you. And it's like, that's really not as impressive as I'd like it to be.
Right.
You know, which is just an interesting, like, it's going to solve all our problems. It's going to take all these jobs away. It's going to do all these things. But when you really get down to it, it's just like, it's just sort of flattening the human expression, right, almost. And it's like, yeah, if you want something that was written by a machine, then you're going to get something that's written by a machine because that's all it knows how to do.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I wish I could remember the name of this person, but if you listen to the podcast On the Media, there was a recent great interview with a journalist, an AI journalist. And one of the things they said that I found to be really illustrative of some of the issues that I see in the discourse around AI. And again, I think it is really just discourse because, I mean, the technologies have their own issues that we can get into. But we're talking about like the hype, like the marketing around AI.
Right.
The journalist said is, okay, what if AI can't get better than the way it is right now without some fundamental technological innovations? Like, if right now we're throwing money in GPUs at the AI problem, we're throwing computing power at AI, we're spending tons of money using tons of electricity and water, and we're starting to see this, like, diminishing returns, right?
Right.
Like, ChatGPT 2 is, like, improved a lot when you get to ChatGPT 3, as far as I understand it. ChatGPT 4 will probably, like, be a little bit less of a delta, right? A little bit less change. And we're starting to see it kind of flatten out. What if it never gets better? What if it stays the way it is right now for the next 10 years? If you think about that context and then all the promises about how transformative AI will be, I don't think that the facts and our evidence really match up with those promises. And so I try not to project my own, like, values-based objections to AI, because I have lots of values-based objections to AI that I haven't talked about so far. But from the just, like, let's have a conversation grounded in reality side of things. Like,
right.
It really does feel like there's a lot of misinformation and, you know, people stretching the truth or talking as if their aspirations are eminently are completely, oh my gosh, inevitable.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like, right, deflating a lot of people because they're like, why would I go into a creative market or, right, a creative career, you know, which for me as somebody who is creative has been the most fulfilling thing that I could do with my life is mm-hmm. you know, devote myself to a creative marketing career. And it's like, oh, I shouldn't do that because AI is going to take it. And it's like, I'm there. I'm in it. I'm doing it. And I use AI, but AI is not doing my job for me. If I relied on AI for every part of my job, I would create subpar content. I would create subpar copy, subpar images. And I mean, so it's like, yeah, if it stays where it is right now, like I hear these promises of, you know, like Renaissance level, you know, it's going to make the next Sistine Chapel or something like that. And it's like, I don't necessarily see that. But that brings up another point, because I know that you're holding back on the environmental concerns and your personal value sets and things like that. Without getting too deep into it, like, it uses a ton of water, it uses a ton of electricity. Both of those things cost money. Both of those things have an environmental capacity, like a sort of a delta, I guess, if you will, yeah, to them, right? This sort of byproduct. And like, that's its own concern, sure. But like, I've even started to think about it from a business standpoint. Like, I hear mm-hmm. the CEO of ChatGPT go like, it's creating an incredible expense for us when you use the word please when you're talking to ChatGPT. And it's like, okay, that's fascinating. So what that means is that, like, these companies have an incentive to increase the compute efficiency of these systems. They have all the incentive to do this because, like you said, they're creating, it's getting to a point of diminishing returns. It's incredibly expensive to run these data centers. Like, yes, they are a great business model. Yes, they potentially provide tax incentives to the places where they are. But then there's the noise, there's the water, there's the electricity, there's these other concerns, yep, which are incredibly valid. But it's like, what's fascinating is that, yeah, we're throwing infrastructure at the problem when I could see the same incentive from ChatGPT's standpoint to create efficiencies, right, within their own product. And it's like, I'm just curious as to what your viewpoint on that is. Is there something that I don't know?
Yeah, I don't think there is anything you don't know. I think you understand this issue entirely perfectly from the way you've talked about it. But there's a couple of complexities. So first, we have an example of a Chinese firm that was able to create a peer technology with less resources than OpenAI did to create ChatGPT. I'm talking about the DeepSeek right. stuff. So I think there is an argument to be made that we can make efficiency gains on this technology for sure, right? Will those efficiency gains lead us to more performant models, like models that seem more human, that produce better results? No, they won't. DeepSeek isn't that much better than ChatGPT. It was just made a lot cheaper, right?
Right.
So the first question that I ask myself is like, okay, are these big American companies that are saying we need like an entire city's worth of electrical infrastructure to power our data center? Is that a good use of our resources? Or should we instead be thinking about like, no, how about you go, like, we don't need you to make a, you know, artificial general intelligence that's going to replace all of my marketing professionals. Instead, I really want you to make something more useful that is cheaper. And, you know, but that's not the promise, right? The promise is a completely transformative technology.
Right.
And I think the real answer to your question is, this is me projecting, right? I do a lot of reading about this. I'm pretty knowledgeable about this topic. But I think reasonable people can disagree about what I'm going to say. But what I'm going to say is, I don't think people know how to make these transformative improvements to generative AI. I think they are operating on faith that throwing more compute and more data at it is going to solve that problem. But there's no evidence to suggest that that's true. We're not seeing the kind of like logarithmic or exponential growth that you described with chips and LEDs and like transistors, right? That we, for years and years, we saw this like amazing growth in those technologies, and that's flattened out since then, but we've completely transformed our society around those gains, right? Hmm. If you think about like what life was like from a technological, like material culture perspective in the 60s versus now, like that's pretty different, you know?
Yes.
Do we think we're going to see the same kind of improvements in AI over that same span of time? I don't know. We saw that exponential curve emerge really early when we started to make transistors and we started to start thinking about microcomputing and those sorts of things. And it was a law. Like we had this like axiom that was like, we can really depend on transistors to have their size over a certain period of time. And that just happened for a long time. And I don't think we're seeing that with AI. It's more of a, like, it's almost like a techno-optimism that if we just put enough energy into this technology, it will do what we want it to do. That's not really how it's worked in the past, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's a fascinating viewpoint. And it's like, it also brings me back to the idea of, I read a book by Neil deGrasse Tyson called Starry mm-hmm. Messenger. And it talks about, which is the name of, in English, it's the name of Galileo's treatise that he brought to the Pope back in the day about how, you know, the Earth is not the center of the universe. And so he chose to call it Starry Messenger, but it was about sort of the radical changes in technology and how every 30 years or so it's different. You live in a different world than 30 years ago. And it's like, it's totally fine. Dogs exist.
Exist, everybody. Dogs exist.
Big.
And I won't apologize for it.
Hot
my throat
take.
Is scratchy. I have dogs. That's just life. All right. Sorry.
I love that. No, yeah, exactly. Quick tangent. It'll happen again, I'm sure. And so, yeah, it's like it's this idea of, you know, 30 years ago, like I was born in 1990. In 1960, the world was all a completely different place in terms of technology, media, you know, everything like that. 1990 to 2020, I would say, you know, I mean, that's just like the birth of the internet, basically, is in that time period, the birth and adoption and, you know, everything to the internet. And then now, and right, almost right on schedule, you know, we've got this new AI thing. And it's like, that 30 years from now viewpoint is something that I can't even connect with, because who knows what that's going to look like, what's that's going to feel like, what that's going to be like. But the other thing that you're totally right on is that early on in the chip, like, isn't it called Moore's Law, where like every like chips will double in processing capacity every year? And it has been consistent. I mean, it was like they saw the trend early enough, and that has been the case. And so it's like, what part of AI has something similar to that, and we haven't seen it yet? Maybe it just has yet to occur or something like that. But yeah, I mean, it's, again, the more that I learn, the more I realize that And I was talking to a VP of data analytics at Bank of America, and she was very she's training herself on machine learning models and on AI principles and things like that, because data analysis is one of those places where AI has made a very big dent in terms of aggregating and sort of being able to understand and interpret data. But of course, it still makes mistakes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so she's training herself on those things, but like I even counseled her and said, like, you should do those things. You should learn these concepts. You should learn these principles, but it's not impossible to get in front of. And I think kids and students, especially who are relying on this so heavily, it's so integrated as part of their life. They have no qualms about using it. They are constantly creating new and interesting ways of engaging with this new piece of technology. But what I've also seen it do is take the wind out of people's sails. And that's where I start to get very concerned, because you can't let your fear prevent you from learning more about this technology, because the more you learn about this technology, the more you start to realize that there are things that it cannot do. And like, you can live in those spaces and you can be the person that either creates the solution for that space where it can't do those things, or you can just exist in that space and, you know, pivot if it starts to invade that space for you. And so that's, again, another thing that I wanted to talk about in this podcast is just like, it's not, hope isn't lost.
No, it's not. And the idea that this is an inevitable thing, that the loudest, most effusive tech bro is promising these things, we don't have to take that on faith. We can ask them to explain why they think that. And there's not a whole lot of that going on.
Right.
And I was at a summit recently about AI and education. And maybe we can take education as a test case here. A lot of the desires around AI, the sense that we need to learn it, that we need to be using it and teaching kids to use it, is based on a fear of missing out. It's based on a fear that these tech bros are right and that society is going to be transformed and we're going to leave kids behind. We've seen transformative technologies in the past. The internet is a great example. I think we did fail to, as a society, to help kids understand how those technologies worked. And it has a huge negative impact. So I'm not the kind of person who's going to say, oh, we'll just ignore it. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. I think it's important to understand it. But we don't have to take it on faith that these people are right. There are some awesome software engineers out there who know a lot about computing. What they may not know a lot about is sociology and, you know, the structure of human society and education and how people that's a whole area of expertise that is frankly devalued by those people because they think that they can just compute their way out of it. But, you know, the human impacts of AI are real. And we have lots of other examples of technologies that came about that had a horrible negative impact on human society. My favorite example of this is the cotton gin. We had a slave owning society in the Southern United States that was declining because they couldn't process cotton as fast as they could harvest it. And the cotton gin comes about and it reestablishes the dominance of slave holding plantations in that society, right? That's a technological innovation that had a transformative negative impact on human society, right?
Oh.
So what I think we need to be thinking about in education especially is, can we help people understand this technology well enough that A, they can prevent themselves from being harmed by it, and B, that they can project out into the world not the most utopian vision of what this looks like, but the most realistic vision of what this looks like, where we minimize harms and maximize benefits. Right now, we are not minimizing harms. We are trying to maximize benefits and extract as much as we can from people and the planet to power those gains, right?
Right.
I don't have the exact stat off the top of my head, but there's several publications that have reported that the energy consumption from AI models has wiped out many of our gains when it comes to renewable energy and addressing climate change and carbon emissions, completely set us back up to 10 years.
Right.
Is that worth it?
That's a crazy impact. I mean, that's a crazy impact for one technological advancement to have. And then I love bringing it back to the classroom in terms of if the loudest voices out there are these tech bros who are saying that this is going to change the world, you know, get with it or get lost. Like, that does have a sociological impact on these kids. Like, they are listening to that. Like, they're listening to YouTubers who are listening to that, who are then repeating that information back to them. They're listening to potentially teachers, potentially parents, potentially the news. I don't know. Anywhere where it's coming from. I mean, kids think about the future. They hear those things. They may not interpret them fully yet, but they have an emotional reaction to them. And it's like, it's our job as educators to follow that emotional reaction, understand where it's coming from, and then help them determine the gray areas, which is from, I'm completely quoting Helen Sapieha, one of our educators who's going to be on another episode of the podcast. And that's one of the things that she did in her school is like, she works in a school that has drones that were flying around the kids' neighborhoods. And like, the kids were obviously spooked by it. And then also, this is a predominantly African-American area. And so, like, the idea of heavy policing in this area, again, heavily spooked these kids. And so she brought in police to have them talk about why they're using drones, what they're using the drones for, what the drones are doing. And then in a project, they have this sort of like hurricane prepping project where like an imaginary hurricane is hitting Hampton Roads. And they have to develop all these plans and determinations about how they might use technology to help people who are stranded, how they might use technology to help people evacuate before the hurricane, et cetera, how to rebuild afterwards. It's a really fun project when she described it. It sounds a lot like a lot of fun for a kid. Yeah, exactly. It sounds really interesting and relevant for kids in Hampton Roads. I grew up in Hampton Roads. Hurricanes happen all the time. Yeah. And so then they started using the idea of drone technology as part of their emergency prep plan. So it's like, they have a negative emotional reaction to drones that is driven by sociological influences. And then she's taking that and she's helping them understand from a computer science standpoint. So yay, computer science education. But like also from a sociological standpoint of like, this is a tool. More than it is a symbol or an emblem of a particular kind of thing or vibe or sociological experience.
Right.
And it's like, that's the same thing that I'm seeing with AI, is it's like people see it as this thing, this symbol, the Batman symbol.
It is more of a symbol than a concrete thing. In a lot of people's minds. Yes.
And turning it into a concrete thing allows you to see it for what it is and allows you to you know, use it. And
it opens the door to critique, right?
Right.
Like, the question of, like, should the police be using drones in that way? That's a question kids can now think about because they understand how the technology works and they've had an experience where they get to try to apply it, right? The other thing I think about a lot in terms of the discourse and the marketing around AI is all of the people who are kind of boosting AI, trying to make it seem like this inevitable wave of like a technological advancement. Those people have a lot to gain from us believing them when they say that, right? If we have an oppressive government that's using drones for surveillance, they have a lot to gain by convincing you that that's fine, right? So, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. I don't know. But we need to have kids explore those topics and have enough fluency with the technical aspects of those technologies to actually make a real critique. And there's a lot of examples of scholars out there. It's not just me, right? Timnit Gebru, Safia Noble, I'm forgetting the name of their organization. There's a research collective that's working on AI critiques and trying to point out all of the existing harms that are happening. The other thing that people talk about all the time when it comes to AI that bugs me to no end is they point out the only possible harm of AI is that it takes people's jobs or that it takes over the planet. It becomes a sentient and then it, like, we have a singularity, whatever.
Right.
Right. That's not what I care about at all. Like, that's a fun science fiction thing right now, and that's I love science fiction, love thinking about science fiction. That's not a serious person conversation.
Right.
The serious person conversation is, how are we harming people right now? Existing harms, I credit Dr. Timnit Gebru with that framing, because it's very powerful, right? And I love that you brought up, I'm going to change the topic a little bit to the classroom and education.
Yeah.
I love that you brought up that kids are seeing the stuff and trying to metabolize it in their classrooms and in their intellectual life, right? If you hear someone say, AI is the future, everyone needs to be using AI all the time to do all these sorts of tasks. And then you have a kid who's like, well, I got to write a book report on Catcher in the Rye. Maybe I'll just use AI. And because since AI is the future, I mean, me being able to understand that literature isn't the future. AI is the future. So I'm going to choose to let AI take care of that for me, because maybe I'm getting enriched by that. Maybe I'm learning about this technology and I'm actually getting a ton out of letting AI do that assignment for me. That's given the information that's out in the world, I don't blame a kid for thinking about stuff like that.
No.
Like they're just not being exposed to critique. And the values that we have in education about what kids should be able to do, we have failed to communicate the importance of those things. Failed to communicate the importance of, like, being able to read and write really well. Like,
right.
We have all these examples of declining literacy rates among children and adults. And my fear is that AI is going to really, is just going to push us over the cliff when it comes to those problems. We have actual real problems in classrooms that are going to be sidelined because we're trying to deal with AI in whatever way we end up dealing with it.
In our next episode, we delve into the world of pedagogy, how AI can fill gaps in skill sets, but contributes to the loss of skill building, and how taking the surrounding context out of learning can clip kids at the knees in their education. Stay tuned, and thanks for listening to Classy Coders from Code VA. If you're interested in hearing more, head to our website at codevirginia.org to fill out a connection request. We're currently in development of an AI Pathways curriculum plan that helps educators encourage students' understanding of AI technologies with middle and high school tracks.